from NPR Music. You're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan, and this is the music of Mark Ronson from his album Uptown Special. Mark Ronson's love for classic music runs deep. He's an English musician whose music education happened in the New York City clubs in the 80s and the 90s. He became an in-demand hip-hop club DJ in his mid-20s. And in 2005, he produced Back to Black, the breakout album for Amy Winehouse. And he's earned, rightfully so, a reputation as a knowledgeable, crate-digging DJ and a producer capable of reinterpreting classic textures to a modern audience and making hits. In his TED Talk last year, Mark Ronson talked about continuing musical traditions in the modern age. It was called How Sampling Transformed Music. You should watch it, and we've put it on our website for you. In this age, where old becomes new, we wanted to talk to Mark Ronson about old music, new music, and how one gives rise to the other. Mark Ronson is in our New York bureau, along with NPR Music's Peter Orloff. We begin with his immersion into DJ culture, a culture of finding old, obscure music to learning the classics.
Just being a DJ in New York, especially at that time, was such an immersion and a crash course in like modern soul, hip-hop, black music history, you know, because you would be learning so much from the other DJs because you're starting out, you're just opening for other DJs. So you're learning so much from the guys you're playing before, these older guys that know so much about, you know, old obscure funk and soul records. And then you're spending your whole weekends digging through crates, going around flea markets and the East Village and all these spots looking for records. Some of them trying to discover new gems, some of them trying to find that record that Busta Rhymes just sampled that's the biggest record in the club at that moment so you can play it. And I guess that was my crash course in music history. I mean, I had a tiny bit of knowledge of theory and classical from university and, you know, piano lessons when I was a kid, but that was my training ground, really, that time. And it informed, you know, my entire sensibility and all the music that I love.
At some point, you learned other instruments as well.
Yeah, I played piano. I played a little bit of guitar. I played a little bit of saxophone. The thing is, I was never really very, very good at one thing, so I sort of jumped around. And in my band in high school, like, I was the rhythm guitar player because I couldn't like shred like the other dude could. And, you know, it was like the era of sort of shredding, I guess, and being a very flashy guitar player. At the time, I was probably like, oh man, I wish I was like awesome and could play Eddie Van Halen Eruption. But I realized probably all those things that I picked up from moving around different instruments and different things worked really well for actually, you know, becoming a producer later, because maybe the good thing is being a producer, sort of understanding, you know, where things sit with different instruments and arrangement wise. So
you got a dad who's a guitar, stepdad who's a guitar player.
Yeah, my stepdad, Mick Jones, was a guitar player, keyboard player, and kind of, you know, the main songwriter for Foreigner, and, you know, wrote incredible songs and sort of like massive ballads. And he met my mother when I was about 7, you know, so that was definitely cool. You know, from the age of 8, there were these kind of multi-track recorders in our house, and I would teach myself how to use it. And there was this old archaic sequencer called the Synclavier, which was one of the
early... I played one of those.
Yeah, so it was one of the early things, and I sort of taught myself how to use it so I could recreate Terence Trent D'Arby's Wishing Well, like at least the first verse and chorus. I was obsessed with that song, and my dad, still living in England, my real dad, I would go back to visit him once or twice a year, and, you know, going to England informed a certain part of my music experience. And so Terence and D'Arby, and I thought it was so cool that I'd kind of got really close to like the sounds and the keyboard and the part that goes like do 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 do. I don't know, it's like a chime or some crazy thing. And I'd bring people over, like my parents' friends, and I'd be like, listen, And they'd be like, yeah, it's Turandarvi's Wishing Well. Like, what's so great about this? And I'd be like, no, but, like, I remade it. Like, it wasn't so exciting. It was just exciting to me. But I got into that, and then I got into samplers a little bit because he had this S950 or S900. It was one of the earlier... Yeah, exactly. God, you really know your stuff. You're a producer. You have
I make music, and then one of my early pieces of music was 83. Was a sampling piece using this and clavier and stuff. So, but go on. I'm sorry.
No, I asked you. I was using this sampler, and there were like three kids in my school that rapped. So they were performing in something. I think it was like the Reverend Al Sharpton like talent show. It was at Stuyvesant, the high school downtown. And so I was like, I'll make you a beat. So because my knowledge was so rudimentary, I didn't know that you could like adjust these different samples and loops of music, drums, and have them play simultaneously in time. I just thought you had to use two separate samplers and just hit play at the same time and hope that they lined up, which is sort of the, you know, rudiments of DJing in a way, because you have two different pieces of music playing on two separate sources, and you're going to line them up the pitch wise so that they mix together. And that's when my friend, you know, one of these rapper kids was like, oh, if you like this, you should probably try DJing, because I was getting very much into hip hop at the time. And, you know, it was kind of 1992 New York. It was a very exciting time. And that's kind of what led me down that path, I guess.
I'm kind of fascinated by the idea of you recreated this Terrence Trent D'Arby song. No one found it at all fascinating but you. And what is the difference between taking something that someone else did and making it your own and making it something that feels relevant, which is sort of what's at the heart of, I think, of what you do?
Well, I mean, you could say that maybe with the covers record, but I'm not really ever usually trying to take anything anybody else does unless I'm covering their music. But with the Terrence and D'Arby thing, I think it's a bit like, I mean, it's the same reason why people sit around campfires and will be playing Beatles songs and Stairway to Heaven for the rest of time, because there's something amazing about holding a guitar in your hand and being able to recreate this thing that seems to have come from magic. It's like seeing the inside of how a clock works or a magic trick. You're like, wow, this thing that is so beautiful and seems so foreign to me, all of a sudden I can now hold this guitar and I can play that. I guess that's sort of a bit what I alluded to in the TED talk about, there's this amazing song that seems so exotic and unreachable, and then all of a sudden you can play it and kind of like insert yourself in the narrative of what that song history is, even if only you and your five friends sitting around the campfire sort of ever really hear it. So I think that was the thing with me with the Terrence Trent D'Arby. It was like, wow, I can actually pull this apart and show that I understand how all of these parts work and then replay it, which of course is only really exciting to me, because anyone else, you would just rather go listen to the Terrence Trent D'Arby version. But there's also, I guess, on the other side of it, are covers that are maybe not as good as the original but still exciting and great in their own right, like when you had all the kind of like, you know, the Four Tops or the Temptations doing Eleanor Rigby or Nina Simone doing To Love Somebody, like covers that are truly kind of special in their own right because you have great artists reinterpreting it. And that's something I also became really into in the sort of in those crate digging days of looking around. If I saw like four guys that looked like a soul band on the cover of a record and they had a cover of Fool on the Hill on the back, I'd be like, oh, this must be interesting. So yeah, for whatever reason, I was always drawn to these covers, and especially covers that drag a song from one genre into another. And that's what really my album version was sort of all about, which was sort of my breakthrough in the UK.
Well, I mean, that kind of makes me think of Valerie when you recorded it, almost a garage rock song, and you and Amy turned it into a soul tune. So that's almost an inversion of things that have a particular kind of currency being given a timeless feel.
Yeah, so I was working on this versioned album because I did really like all these records by bands like The Jam and Radiohead, and I was playing in mostly hip-hop clubs or hip-hop and funk clubs, and you know, you can't play those sort of records unless you want something hurled at you in the DJ booth. So I just thought, like, wow, wouldn't it be cool if I could sort of reimagine or remake these songs in a way that, like, I could play them to my crowd and it would get over. So I started to kind of, like, take some of my favorite songs, like Just by Radiohead, and I just thought they were just going to be for my own DJ sets, but the Radiohead one came out, and Zane Lowe and Giles Peterson started playing it on Radio 1 in the UK. So suddenly people were like, oh, do you have any more of those? Like, you know, I kind of had labels kind of coming around. And so at the end of it, I had been working with Amy, you know, for a while on Back to Black, and I said, hey, Amy, do you want to do a song for this album? And it was funny because it's not like, the concept of the album was to take indie rock songs. It's not like Amy, really. She's like, all she listens to is like 60s doo-wop soul and Nas, you know? So, but she happened to know this song, Valerie, by the Zootons, which I didn't even know. And to be fair, she played it for me. She's like, yeah, there's this song, Valerie, by the Zootons, that, you know, they play it down at my local, which is like the pub. And I heard it, and I was like, really? You want to do this song? I didn't hear it, but I guess, like, she had such a musical brain under all that stuff. She heard the soul progression, because that's what that chord progression is, quite classic. And I know she must have, like, sung it along with the thing, or, you know, sung it out loud. She, like, she knew that it was going to be special when she sung it.
Can we play a little bit of the Zootons for those who have not ever heard it?
Sure.
Just a second of the original. We're going to play a song by the Zootons called Valerie. See why she might have liked that.
Yeah, I'm hearing it again for the first time in a while, and I was like, that, you know, and Dave, who wrote that song from the Zootons, you know, they're a Liverpool band, and there's such a strong history with Liverpool and, you know, American black music and so on. That's a pretty great song, actually, and it's kind of nice hearing the original again for the first time in a while.
Let's see what you did with it, then we can talk about that. Hang on a second.
Well, sometimes I go out by myself and I look across the water. And I think of all the things.
And this version is...
Yeah, so that's the original version that we cut that day in the studio. And it was a nice day in the studio because all the musicians from the Daptones, you know, Dap King, such incredible musicians, Tommy, Homer, Victor, Nick, and Binky had played on Back to Black, but Amy had actually never met them. And Back to Black had been out for a month and was starting to be, like, you know, really heralded as this record. And the funny thing is Amy had never met the band because she had to go back to England. So it was the first day she met the band. We went out to Bushwick to Daptone and cut this. And then as everybody was leaving, like, I just had this nagging thing in the back of my mind. I was like, it's so great and it's really soulful and lovely, but, like, we should just make one really dumb version where just the bass and the drums are just going like doonch goon doon goon doon, like literally everyone's packing up their instruments, like, and like, really, Mark, like, unpack the instruments, the whole thing. I don't know if anybody ever noticed, pays attention, but she's actually saying her ad lib at the beginning of the song is, I'm sorry, Charlie Murphy, I was having too much fun, from the Rick James sketch from Dave Chappelle.
Here we go, let's hear.
Hi, it's rolling.
I'm sorry, Charlie Murphy, I was having too much fun.
when you played the Trent, we talked about the Terrence Trent D'Arby song before, and you've made your own version of it. I'm trying to get back at this for a minute, but what makes the difference between taking something that somebody else's and then turning it into your own? What can, is there something you put your finger on that you, where you begin to own the song?
I, you know, like, there's no formula. It's almost like the same as, like, is there a formula for writing a hit song? It's not. It's just something magic happens somewhere in the middle, and you're like, wow, I believe that you wrote this song, and I'm hearing it for the first time. And you know, obviously, pulling it out of the genre really helps, because you kind of take away some of, like, the, you know, the other baggage that you have, like, by taking out the heavy guitars and this kind of stuff that's in the Zootones version. But I think Amy's voice is just, I think she could just kind of do that with anything. Like, it was so commanding and quite immediately identifiable. And she also, because she was more of a fan of jazz music than any contemporary pop music. I mean, jazz was always about sticking vaguely to the chord chart, but you would just pull the melody and the riff way far apart from anything, the version of that song that had been done before you. So, that's why, you know, and every time she would sing this song live, it would always be completely different each way, because it made her quite bored to just sing it the way that it was, that she had recorded it. It
made me think that in fact, at least in the 50s and 60s, a lot of the jazz that ever made it to the airwaves, and there wasn't much, but the jazz that didn't make it to the popular airwaves were cover songs. And there is this notion that we don't really know what we like, but we like what we know.
I know what you're saying there. And I also like Ramsey Lewis, like all those records that he made on Cadet in the 60s, where he's doing, like, what's the Beatles cover that he does that's so gorgeous, Dear Prudence. I guess that's the thing, like, I don't know if it's McCartney or Lennon, but wrote this absolutely gorgeous melody that Ramsey Lewis is, like, probably thinking, like, okay, I'm probably not going to write anything melodically that's stronger than this, but I'm going to take it and make it my own. It's going to sound incredible, and I'm going to have this killing rhythm section behind me. And that's incredibly enjoyable to listen to, like, at least for me. Like, I'm not thinking, like, oh, he was lazy, he didn't write his own song. It's just like, wow, I get to take two things I love, like, kind of wonderful British pop melody and then incredible jazz playing. I don't really know. I mean, it's so different, because it's just everybody's taste. But that, I love soul music, and I kind of love, like, probably some classic, like, British sense of melody. So all those covers in that era combine both.
Well, it's a funny era, because right in that era, right around 68, when Ramsey Lewis did that Mother Nature Son record, writing original music as a singer was not the thing to do. You took somebody else's song. It could be somebody else's song that was famous, or somebody else would write it for you. But we came into an age in the middle and late 60s where if you wanted to have any credibility at all, you would write your own thing and you would sing it. What fascinates me about what you do is that people are writing their own stuff, and it is original music, but yet it's kind of a mix, because it's drawing so much on the past.
We're all influenced and children of the music that came before it. What was cool about also DJing in those clubs in New York at that time, like, your massive records, when you're playing records from the, like, disco, late 90s, early 80s R&B, that era, you weren't playing Michael Jackson and Earth, Wind & Fire and Lionel Richie and the obvious stuff. You were playing things like Tom Brown, Funking for Jamaica, and Positive Force, We Got the Funk, and Gil Scott-Heron, and these slightly more obscure, you know, Zapp and Roger Troutman, like these more obscure black dance records. And maybe it was because, I don't know, like, at that time when you first discover the thing you love and you're just doing it all the time, that's all you ever want to do, you're really branded by that music. And that's it. And I think, like, with this new record, Uptown Special, I decided that I was just going to go back to the thing that I sort of know the most. But at the same time, in my head, the MO is not to rehash that or retread it. It's just, this is the music I love. When me, Bruno, and Jeff sit down at our instruments and start jamming, we're most likely not going to break into, like, a Mahavishnu Orchestra record. Like, we're going to just, like, Bruno's going to play, like, a simple four-on-the-floor, like, funk beat at 115 beats per minute, and Jeff is going to start playing some keys on it, and that's kind of what it is, you know?
I play this a little bit.
This hit that ice cold, Michelle fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces. Stylin', wildin', living it up in the city. Got Chucks on with Saint Laurent, gotta kiss myself, I'm so pretty. I'm too hot. Call the police and the fireman, I'm too hot. Make a dragon wanna retire, man, I'm too hot. Say my name, you know who I am, I'm too hot. And my band bout that money, break it down. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you.
Saturday night and we in the spot.
Don't believe me, just watch. Just watch. Don't believe me, just watch. Don't believe me, just watch. Hey.
So that was a huge song.
Yeah. You know, I was kind of listening to it and just in the framework of what we were just talking about. And I think a lot of what happens is that, like, we're obviously so impressed and in awe of an era where people played their instruments live and you could have like these killing bands, whether it was Lakeside or Earth, Wind & Fire, whoever, playing their instruments and still making music that sounds great on the dance floor. Like, dance became, you know, after the era of house and hip hop, like, became, dance music became something that was made by machines, and suddenly you hear somebody playing like a live drum kit and a band jamming, and it just sounds like you're in like a bad R&B bar in the West Village. Like, it's suddenly what was cool and what sounded great and dynamic on the dance floor became very much not about people playing their instruments. And I guess we're just still in the thralls of that era, and I love the musicianship and that stuff, and showing, whether it's, you know, with this record or other stuff that I've done, that you can capture that feeling and have, you know, live musicianship and this kind of stuff and make a dance record. And I think, like, I want to make a record that sort of stands up there with my favorite classic records, like that I play when I DJ. Not necessarily something that borrows from them, rips them off, but, like, I want to know that when I play a Lakeside record or a Tom Brown record or something like that, and I can play Uptown Funk right after it and it sits up there with them. Those are the things maybe that probably are going on, but I definitely, you know, it's really important for me, like, I definitely don't want to be living in the past. Like, you're trying to take those things that you love and sort of recreate it for now, you know?
Yeah.
You're not trying to hijack nostalgia, I think, is what something that you said in the TED Talk, which is a great thing to watch, by the way, for anybody who doesn't look, search for Mark Ronson's TED Talk. We're in an era now where there are so many people making music that has its roots in sound long before they were even alive. It might be because it's in their parents' record collection. It's sort of hard to say, but it's certainly deep in the air in R&B these days. I guess the question is, when will it end? where can it take us? For someone who grew up in those eras, the familiarity is why I like it. I'm not sure I'm always feeling that it's taken us anywhere new. And I guess I want that.
Yeah. I feel like if you look at the biggest things of the past few years, especially in R&B, you have things like The Weeknd. I feel like melodically, you know, touches on some like really classic artists and there's some great songs there. But I feel like production-wise, it's definitely something that really hasn't happened like in the past history of R&B, and I feel like as well with Miguel, you know, it's quite daring with the style of production. Then you listen to somebody like FKA Twigs, it's like
right. Sort
of like bending the fabric of what can be even considered like meter and whatever. So I think that there's a lot. It's funny because I love 90s R&B. Like, that's when I started DJing. I love Aaliyah. I love all those early Timbaland records. And I listen to a lot of records today and I'm like, wow, this could have been made sort of 20 years ago, but I don't know if that's just grumpy old man syndrome, because when I listen a little bit deeper, like, there's definitely things that are very much, you know, very much now. And, you know, obviously musical is cyclical, whether it's in kind of 20-year cycles, 30-year cycles, but you know, you add to it. There might be one or two little bits of kind of something progressive or innovative in those things that even if they draw from old stuff that takes it into this next era. And, you know, with the thing with Uptown Funk is like, it's got to the point like where most of my friends never want to hear that song again. Like, they grimace when it comes on the radio. But 6-year-olds and 5-year-olds and kids under that, like, that's all I get is videos of people's kids and nephews and nieces, like, freaking out in the back of the car when it comes on. And they've never heard Rick James. You know, they've never heard James Brown. They never heard Kool and the Gang. They don't know George Clinton, Parliament, Funkadelic. So the fact that those kids are... I remember my friend told me, he's like, yeah, my son was like, I want to listen to some more music like that, Dad. So he's just started playing in Prince and Rick James now, and his, like, 6-year-old is super into that stuff. So I guess it's like every generation is going to pick up a little bit from the old stuff and take it forward.
And the cycle begins again.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you all. I really appreciate this. And I hope one day we actually meet in person. I'd love to shake your hand.
Cool. Me too. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Mark Ronson, his new record's called Uptown Special. I'm Bob Boylan, along with NPR Music's Peter Orloff. It's All Songs Considered.